During periods of heavy rain, they were all apt to overflow their banks. If it rains 2 weeks, the whole damn town gets a sinus infection, Stuttering Bill's dad had said once. The Kanduskeag was caged in a concrete canal 2 miles long as it passed through downtown. This canal dived under Main Street at the intersection of Main and Canal, becoming an underground river for half a mile or so before surfacing again at Basie Park. Canal Street, where most of Derry's bars were ranked like felons in a police lineup, paralleled the canal on its way out of town, and every few weeks or so the police would have to fish some drunk's car out of the water, which was polluted to drop-dead levels by sewage and mill wastes. Fish were caught from time to time in the canal, but they were inedible mutants. On the northeastern side of town, the canal side, the river had been managed to at least some degree. A thriving commerce went on all along it in spite of the occasional flooding. People walked beside the canal, sometimes hand in hand. If the wind was right, that was. If it was wrong, the stench took much of the romance out of such strolling. And at Basie Park, which faced the high school across the canal, there were sometimes Boy Scout campouts and Cub Scout wiener roasts. In 1969, the citizens would be shocked and sickened to discover that hippies, one of them had actually sewed an American flag on the seat of his pants, and that pinko faggot was busted before you could say Gene McCarthy, were smoking dope and trading pills up there. By 69, Basie Park had become a regular open-air pharmacy. You just wait, people said. Somebody'll get killed before they put a stop to it. And, of course, someone finally did. A 17-year-old boy had been found dead by the canal, his veins full of almost pure heroin, what the kids called a tight white rail. After that, the druggies began to drift away from Basie Park, and there were even stories that the kid's ghost was haunting the area. The story was stupid, of course, but if it kept the speed freaks and the nodders away, it was at least a useful stupid story. On the southwestern side of town, the river presented even more of a problem. Here the hills had been deeply cut open by the passing of the Great Glacier, and further wounded by the endless water erosion of the Kanduskeag and its webwork of tributaries. The bedrock showed through in many places like the half-unearthed bones of dinosaurs. Veteran employees of the Derry Public Works Department knew that, following the fall's first hard frost, they could count on a good deal of sidewalk repair on the southwestern side of town. The concrete would contract and grow brittle, and then the bedrock would suddenly shatter up through it, as if the earth meant to hatch something. What grew best in the shallow soil which remained was plants with shallow root systems and hardy natures. Weeds and trash plants, in other words. Scruffy trees, thick low bushes, and virulent infestations of poison ivy and poison oak grew everywhere they were allowed a foothold. The southwest was where the land fell away steeply to the area that was known in Derry as the Barrens. The Barrens, which were anything but barren, were a messy tract of land about a mile and a half wide by 3 miles long. It was bounded by Upper Kansas Street on one side and by Old Cape on the other. Old Cape was a low-income housing development, and the drainage was so bad over there that there were stories of toilets and sewer pipes actually exploding. The Kanduskeag ran through the center of the Barrens. The city had grown up to the northeast and on both sides of it, but the only vestiges of the city down there were Derry Pump House No. 3, the municipal sewage pumping station, and the city dump. Seen from the air, the Barrens looked like a big green dagger pointing at downtown. To Ben, all this geography mated with geology meant was a vague awareness that there were no more houses on his right side now. The land had dropped away. A rickety whitewashed railing, about waist high, ran beside the sidewalk, a token gesture of protection. He could faintly hear running water. It was the soundtrack to his continuing fantasy. He paused and looked out over the Barrens, still imagining her eyes, the clean smell of her hair. From here, the Kanduskeag was only a series of twinkles seen through breaks in the thick foliage. Some kids said that there were mosquitoes as big as sparrows down there at this time of the year. Others said there was quicksand as you approached the river. Ben didn't believe it about the mosquitoes, but the idea of quicksand scared him. Slightly to his left, he could see a cloud of circling, diving seagulls. The dump. Their cries reached him faintly. Across the way, he could see Derry Heights and the low roofs of the old Cape houses closest to the Barrens. To the right of Old Cape, pointing skyward like a squat white finger, was the dairy standpipe. Directly below him, a rusty culvert stuck out of the earth, spilling discolored water down the hill in a glimmering little stream which disappeared into the tangled trees and bushes. Ben's pleasant fantasy of Beverly was suddenly broken by one far more grim. What if a dead hand flopped out of that culvert right now, right this second, while he was looking? And suppose that when he turned to find a phone and call the police, a clown was standing there. A funny clown wearing a baggy suit with big orange puffs for buttons. Suppose... A hand fell on Ben's shoulder and he screamed. There was laughter. He whirled around, shrinking against the white fence separating the safe, sane sidewalk of Kansas Street from the wildly undisciplined barrens. The railing creaked audibly and saw Henry Bowers, Belch Huggins, and Victor Chris standing there.
"Hi, kids," Henry said.
"What do you want?"
Ben asked, trying to sound brave.
"I want to beat you up," Henry said.
He seemed to contemplate this prospect soberly, even gravely. But, oh, his black eyes sparkled.
"I got to teach you something, Tits. You won't mind. You like to learn new things, don't you?"
He reached for Ben. Ben ducked away.
"Hold him, you guys."
Belch and Victor seized his arms. Ben squealed. It was a cowardly sound, rabbity and weak, but he couldn't help it.
"Please, God, don't let them make me cry, and don't let them break my watch," Ben thought wildly.
He didn't know if they would get around to breaking his watch or not, but he was pretty sure he would cry. He was pretty sure he would cry plenty before they were through with him.
"Cheese him. He sounds just like a pig," Victor said.
He twisted Ben's wrist. "Don't he sound like a pig?"
"He sure do," Belch giggled.
Ben lunged first one way and then the other. Belch and Victor went with him easily, letting him lunge, then yanking him back. Henry grabbed the front of Ben's sweatshirt and yanked it upward, exposing his belly. It hung over his belt in a swollen droop.
"Look at that gut," Henry cried in amazed disgust. "Jesus, please us."
Victor and Belch laughed some more. Ben looked around wildly for help. He could see no one. Behind him, down on the barrens, crickets drowsed and seagulls screamed.
"You just better quit," he said.
He wasn't blubbering yet, but he was close to it.
"You just better."
"Or what?" Henry asked, as if he was honestly interested.
"Or what, Tits? Or what, huh?"
Ben suddenly found himself thinking of Broderick Crawford, who played Dan Matthews on Highway Patrol. That bastard was tough. That bastard was mean. That bastard took zero shit from anybody. And then he burst into tears. Dan Matthews would have belted these guys right through the fence, down the embankment, and into the pucker brush. He would have done it with his belly.
"Oh, boy, look at the baby," Victor chortled.
Belch joined in. Henry smiled a little, but his face still held that grave, reflective cast, that look that was somehow almost sad. It frightened Ben. It suggested he might be in for more than just a beating. As if to confirm this idea, Henry reached into his jeans pocket and brought out a buck knife. Ben's terror exploded. He had been whipsawing his body futilely to either side. Now he suddenly lunged straight forward. There was an instant when he believed he was going to get away. He was sweating heavily, and the boys holding his arms had greasy grips at best. Belch managed to hold on to his right wrist, but just barely. He pulled entirely free of Victor. Another lunge. Before he could make it, Henry stepped forward and gave him a shove. Ben flew backward. The railing creaked more loudly this time, and he felt it give a little under his weight. Belch and Victor grabbed him again.
"Now you hold him," Henry said. "You hear me?" "Sure, Henry," Belch said. He sounded a trifle uneasy. "He ain't gonna get away. Don't worry."
Henry stepped forward until his flat stomach almost touched Ben's belly. Ben stared at him, tears spilling helplessly out of his wide eyes.
"Caught. I'm caught,"
a part of his mind yammered. He tried to stop it. He couldn't think at all with that yammering going on. But it wouldn't stop. "Caught. Caught. Caught." Henry pulled out the blade, which was long and wide and engraved with his name. The tip glittered in the afternoon sunshine.
"I'm going to test you now," Henry said in that same reflective voice. "It's exam time, Tits, and you better be ready."
Ben wept. His heart thundered madly in his chest. Snot ran out of his nose and collected on his upper lip. His library books lay in a scatter at his feet. Henry stepped on Bulldozer, glanced down, and dealt it into the gutter with a side swipe of one black engineer boot.
Here's the first question on your exam, Tits. When somebody says, "Let me copy during finals," what are you going to say?
Yes, Ben exclaimed immediately. I'm going to say yes, sure, okay, copy all you want.
The buck's tip slid through 2 inches of air and pressed against Ben's stomach. It was as cold as an ice cube tray just out of the frigid air. Ben gasped his belly away from it. For a moment, the world went gray. Henry's mouth was moving, but Ben couldn't tell what he was saying. Henry was like a TV with the sound turned off, and the world was swimming, swimming.
Don't you dare faint, the panicky voice shrieked. If you faint, he may get mad enough to kill you.
The world came back into some kind of focus. He saw that both Belch and Victor had stopped laughing. They looked nervous, almost scared. Seeing that had the effect of a head-clearing slap on Ben.
All of a sudden, they don't know what he's going to do or how far he might go. However bad you thought things were, that's how bad they really are. Maybe even a little worse. You've got to think. If you never did before or never do again, you better think now. Because his eyes say they're right to look nervous. His eyes say he's crazy as a bedbug.
That's the wrong answer, Tits, Henry said. If just anyone says, "Let me copy," I don't give a red fuck what you do. Got it?
Yes, Ben said, his belly hitching with sobs. Yes, I got it.
Well, okay. That's one wrong, but the biggies are still coming up. You ready for the biggies?
I guess so.
A car came slowly toward them. It was a dusty 51 Ford with an old man and woman propped up in the front seat like a pair of neglected department store mannequins. Ben saw the old man's head turn slowly toward him. Henry stepped closer to Ben, hiding the knife. Ben could feel its point dimpling his flesh just above his belly button. It was still cold. He didn't see how that could be, but it was.
Go ahead, yell, Henry said. You'll be picking your fucking guts off your sneakers.
They were close enough to kiss. Ben could smell the sweet smell of juicy fruit gum on Henry's breath. The car passed and continued on down Kansas Street, as slow and serene as the pace car in the Tournament of Roses parade.
All right, Tits, here's the second question. If I say, "Let me copy," during finals, what are you going to say?
Yes, I'll say yes right away.
Henry smiled.
That's good. You got that one right, Tits. Now here's the third question. How am I going to be sure you never forget that?
I don't know, Ben whispered.
Henry smiled. His face lit up and was for a moment almost handsome.
I know, he said, as if he had discovered a great truth. I know, Tits. I'll carve my name on your big fat gut.
Victor and Belch abruptly began laughing again. For a moment, Ben felt a species of bewildered relief, thinking it had all been nothing but make-believe. A little chuck and jive the three of them had whomped up to scare the living hell out of him. But Henry Bowers wasn't laughing, and Ben suddenly understood that Victor and Belch were laughing because they were relieved. It was obvious to both of them that Henry couldn't be serious. Except Henry was. The buck knife slid upward, smooth as butter. Blood welled in a bright red line on Ben's pallid skin.
Hey!
Victor cried. The word came out, muffled in a startled gulp.
Hold him, Henry snarled. You just hold him, hear me?
Now there was nothing grave and reflective on Henry's face. Now it was the twisted face of a devil.
Cheese and crow, Henry, don't really cut him,
Belch screamed, and his voice was high, almost a girl's voice. Everything happened fast then, but to Ben Hanscom, it all seemed slow. It all seemed to happen in a series of shutter clicks, like action stills in a Life magazine photo essay. His panic was gone. He had discovered something inside him suddenly, and because it had no use for panic, that something just ate the panic whole. In the first shutter click, Henry had snatched his sweatshirt all the way up to his nipples. Blood was pouring from the shallow vertical cut above his belly button. In the second shutter click, Henry drew the knife down again, operating fast, like a lunatic battle surgeon under an aerial bombardment. Fresh blood flowed.
Backward,
Ben thought coldly as blood flowed down and pooled between the waistband of his jeans and his skin.
Got to go backward. That's the only direction I can get away in.
Belch and Victor weren't holding him anymore. In spite of Henry's command, they had drawn away. They had drawn away in horror. But if he ran, Bowers would catch him. In the third shutter click, Henry connected the two vertical slashes with a short horizontal line. Ben could feel blood running into his underpants now, and a sticky snail trail was creeping down his left thigh. Henry leaned back momentarily, frowning with the studied concentration of an artist painting a landscape. After H comes E, Ben thought, and that was all it took to get him moving. He pulled forward a little bit, and Henry shoved him back again. Ben pushed with his legs, adding his own force to Henry's. He hit the whitewashed railing between Kansas Street and the drop into the Barrens. As he did, he raised his right foot and planted it in Henry's belly. This was not a retaliatory act. Ben only wanted to increase his backward force. And yet when he saw the expression of utter surprise on Henry's face, he was filled with a clear, savage joy. A feeling so intense that for a split second, he thought the top of his head was going to come off. Then there was a cracking, splintering sound from the railing. Ben saw Victor and Belch catch Henry before he could fall on his ass in the gutter next to the remains of Bulldozer, and then Ben was falling backward into space. He went with a scream that was half a laugh. Ben hit the slope on his back and buttocks just below the culvert he had spotted earlier. It was a good thing he landed below it. If he had landed on it, he might well have broken his back. As it was, he landed on a thick cushion of weeds and bracken and barely felt the impact. He did a backward somersault, feet and legs snapping over his head. He landed sitting up and went sliding down the slope backward like a kid on a big green shoot-the-shoot. His sweatshirt pulled up around his neck, his hands grabbing for purchase and doing nothing but yanking out tuft after tuft of bracken and witchgrass. He saw the top of the embankment. It seemed impossible that he had just been standing up there, receding with crazy cartoon speed. He saw Victor and Belch, their faces round white O's, staring down at him. He had time to mourn his library books. Then he fetched up against something with agonizing force and nearly bit his tongue in half. It was a downed tree, and it checked Ben's fall by nearly breaking his left leg. He clawed his way back up the slope a little bit, pulling his leg free with a groan. The tree had stopped him about halfway down. Below, the bushes were thicker. Water falling from the culvert ran over his hands in thin streams. There was a shriek from above him. Ben looked up again and saw Henry Bowers come flying over the drop, his knife clenched between his teeth. He landed on both feet, body thrown backward at a steep angle so he would not overbalance. He skidded to the end of a gigantic set of footprints and then began to run down the embankment at a series of gangling kangaroo leaps.
"I'm going to kill it!"
Henry was shrieking around the knife, and Ben didn't need a UN translator to tell him Henry was saying, "I'm going to kill you, tits."
"I'm going to fucking kill you."
Now, with that cold general's eye he had discovered up above on the sidewalk, Ben saw what he had to do. He managed to gain his feet just before Henry arrived, the knife now in his hand and held straight out in front of him like a bayonet. Ben was peripherally aware that the left leg of his jeans was shredded, and his leg was bleeding much more heavily than his stomach, but it was supporting him, and that meant it wasn't broken. At least he hoped that's what it meant. Ben crouched slightly to maintain his precarious balance, and as Henry grabbed at him with one hand and swept the knife in a long, flat arc with the other, Ben stepped aside. He lost his balance, but as he fell down, he stuck out his shredded left leg. Henry's shin struck it, and his legs were booted out from under him with great efficiency. For a moment, Ben gaped, his terror overcome with a mixture of awe and admiration. Henry Bowers appeared to be flying exactly like Superman over the fallen tree where Ben had stopped. His arms were straight out in front of him, the way George Reeves held his arms out on the TV show. Only George Reeves always looked like flying was as natural as taking a bath or eating lunch on the back porch. Henry looked like someone had shoved a hot poker up his ass. His mouth was opening and closing. A string of saliva was shooting back from one corner of it, and as Ben watched, it splattered against the lobe of Henry's ear. Then Henry crashed back to earth. The knife flew out of his hand. He rolled over on one shoulder, landed on his back, and slid away into the bushes with his legs splayed into a V. There was a yell, a thud, and then silence. Ben sat, dazed, looking at the matted place in the bushes where Henry had done his disappearing act. Suddenly, rocks and pebbles began to bounce by him. He looked up again. Victor and Belch were now descending the embankment. They were moving more carefully than Henry, and hence more slowly, but they would reach him in 30 seconds or less if he didn't do something. He moaned, would this lunacy never end?
keeping his eye on them, he clambered over the downed tree and began to scramble down the embankment, panting harshly. He had a stitch in his side. His tongue hurt like hell. The bushes were now almost as tall as Ben himself. The randy green smell of stuff growing out of control filled his nose. He could hear running water somewhere close, chuckling over stones and rilling between them. His feet slipped, and here he went again, rolling and sliding, smashing the back of his hand against a jutting rock, shooting through a patch of thorns that hooked blue-gray puffs of cotton from his sweatshirt and little divots of meat from his hands and cheeks. He slammed to a jarring halt, sitting up, with his feet in the water. Here was a little curving stream which wound its way into a thick stand of second-growth trees to his right. It looked as dark as a cave in there. He looked to his left and saw Henry Bowers lying on his back in the middle of the stream. His half-open eyes showed only whites. Blood trickled from one ear and ran toward Ben in delicate threads. Oh, my God, I killed him. Oh, my God, I'm a murderer. Oh, my God. Forgetting that Belch and Victor were behind him, or perhaps understanding they would lose all interest in beating the shit out of him when they discovered their fearless leader was dead, Ben splashed 20 feet upstream to where Henry lay, his shirt in ribbons, his jeans soaked black, one shoe gone. Ben was vaguely aware that there was precious little left of his own clothes and that his body was one big rattletrap of aches and pains. His left ankle was the worst. It had already puffed tight against his soaking sneaker, and he was favoring it so badly that he was really not walking, but lurching like a sailor on shore for the first time after a long sea voyage. He bent over Henry Bowers. Henry's eyes popped wide open. He grabbed Ben's calf with one scraped and bloody hand. His mouth worked, and although nothing but a series of whistling aspirations emerged, Ben could still make out what he was saying.
Kill you, you fat shit.
Henry was trying to pull himself up, using Ben's leg as a pole. Ben pulled backward frantically. Henry's hand slipped down, then off. Ben flew backward, whirling his arms, and fell on his ass for a record-breaking third time in the last 4 minutes. He also bit his tongue again. Water splashed up around him. A rainbow glimmered for an instant in front of Ben's eyes. Ben didn't give a fuck about the rainbow. He didn't give a fuck about finding a pot of gold. He would settle for his miserable fat life. Henry rolled over, tried to stand, fell back, managed to get to his hands and knees, and finally tottered to his feet. He stared at Ben with those black eyes. The front of his flat top now leaned this way and that, like corn husks after a high wind has passed through. Ben was suddenly angry. No, this was more than being angry. He was infuriated. He had been walking with his library books under his arm, having an innocent little daydream about kissing Beverly Marsh, bothering nobody. And look at this. Just look. Pants shredded, left ankle maybe broken, badly sprained for sure. Leg all cut up, tongue all cut up, Henry goddamn Bowers' monogram on his stomach. How about all that, happy, crappy sports fans? But it was probably the thought of his library books, for which he was liable, that drove him to charge Henry Bowers. His lost library books and his mental image of how reproachful Mrs. Sterrett's eyes would become when he told her. Whatever the reason, cuts, sprain, library books, or even the thought of the soggy and probably illegible rank card in his back pocket, it was enough to get him moving. He lumbered forward, squashy keds spatting in the shallow water, and kicked Henry squarely in the balls. Henry uttered a horrid rusty scream that sent birds beating up from the trees. He stood spraddle-legged for a moment, hands clasping his crotch, staring unbelievingly at Ben.
Ugh,
he said in a small voice.
Right,
Ben said.
Ugh,
Henry said, in an even smaller voice.
Right,
Ben said again. Henry sank slowly back to his knees, not so much falling as folding up. He was still looking at Ben with those unbelieving black eyes.
Ugh.
Damn right, Ben said. Henry fell on his side, still clutching his testicles, and began to roll slowly from side to side.
Ugh,
Henry moaned.
My balls, ugh. Oh, you broke my balls, ugh, ugh.
He was now beginning to gain a little force, and Ben started to back away a step at a time. He was sickened by what he had done, but he was also filled with a kind of righteous, paralyzed fascination.
Ugh, my fucking sack, ugh, ugh. Oh, my fucking balls.
Ben might have remained in the area for an untold length of time, perhaps even until Henry recovered enough to come after him. But just then a rock struck him above the right ear with such a deep drilling pain that, until he felt warm blood flowing again, Ben thought he had been stung by a wasp. He turned and saw the other two striding up the middle of the stream toward him. They each had a handful of water-rounded rocks. Victor pegged one, and Ben heard it whistle past his ear. He ducked, and another struck his right knee, making him yell with surprised hurt. A third bounced off his right cheekbone, and that eye filled with water. He scrambled for the far bank and climbed it as fast as he could, grabbing onto protruding roots and hauling on handfuls of bushes. He made it to the top. One final stone struck his buttocks as he pulled himself up and took a quick look back over his shoulder. Belch was kneeling beside Henry while Victor stood half a dozen feet away, firing stones. One the size of a baseball clipped through the man-high bushes beside Ben. He had seen enough. In fact, he had seen much more than enough. Worst of all, Henry Bowers was getting up again. Like Ben's own Timex watch, Henry could take a licking and keep on ticking. Ben turned and smashed his way into the bushes, lumbering along in a direction he hoped was west. If he could cross to the old Cape side of the Barrens, he could beg a dime off somebody and take the bus home. And when he got there, he would lock the door behind him and bury these tattered, bloody clothes in the trash, and his crazy dream would finally be over. Ben thought of himself sitting in his chair in the living room, freshly tubbed, wearing his fuzzy red bathrobe, watching Daffy Duck cartoons on The Mighty 90, and drinking milk through a strawberry flavor straw. Hold that thought, he told himself grimly, and kept lumbering along. Bushes sprang into his face. Ben pushed them aside. Thorns reached and clawed. He tried to ignore them. He came to a flat area of ground that was black and mucky. A thick stand of bamboo-like growth spread across it, and a fetid smell rose from the earth. An ominous thought, quicksand, slipped across the foreground of his mind like a shadow as he looked at the sheen of standing water deeper into the grove of bamboo stuff. He didn't want to go in there. Even if it wasn't quicksand, the mud would suck his sneakers off. He turned right instead, running along the front of the bamboo grove and finally into a patch of real woods. The trees, mostly firs, were thick, growing everywhere, battling each other for a little space and sun. But there was less undergrowth, and he could move faster. He was no longer sure what direction he was moving in, but still thought he was, on measure, a little ahead of the game. The barrens were enclosed by dairy on three sides and bounded by the half-finished turnpike extension on the fourth. Sooner or later, he would come out somewhere. His stomach throbbed painfully, and he pulled up the remains of his sweatshirt for a look. He winced and drew a whistle of air in over his teeth. His belly looked like a grotesque Christmas tree ball, all caked red blood and smeared green from his slide down the embankment. He pulled the sweatshirt down again. Looking at that mess made him feel like blowing lunch. Now he heard a low humming noise from ahead. It was one steady note just above the low range of his hearing. An adult, intent only on getting the hell out of there. The mosquitoes had found Ben now, and while nowhere near as big as sparrows, they were pretty big. Would have ignored it, or simply not heard it at all. But Ben was a boy, and he was already getting over his fright. He swerved to his left and pushed through some low laurel bushes. Beyond them, sticking out of the ground, were the top 3 feet of a cement cylinder about 4 feet wide. It was capped with a vented iron manhole cover. The cover was stamped with the words, Dairy Sewer Department. The sound, this close it was more a drone than a hum, was coming from someplace deep inside. Ben put one eye to a vent hole but could see nothing. He could hear that drone and water running down there someplace, but that was all. He took a breath, got a whiff of a sour smell that was both dank and shitty, and drew back with a wince. It was a sewer, that was all. Or maybe a combined sewer and drainage tunnel. There were plenty of those in flood-conscious Derry. No big deal. But it had given him a funny sort of chill. Part of it was seeing the handiwork of a man in all this overgrown jumble of wilderness, but he supposed part of it was the shape of the thing itself, that concrete cylinder jutting out of the ground. Ben had read H.G. Wells' The Time Machine the year before, first the classics comics version and then the whole book. This cylinder with its vented iron cap reminded him of the wells which led down into the country of the slumped and horrible Morlocks. He moved away from it quickly, trying to find West again. He got to a little clearing and turned until his shadow was as directly behind him as he could get it. Then he headed off in a straight line. 5 minutes later, he heard more running water ahead and voices, kids' voices. He stopped to listen, and that was when he heard snapping branches and other voices behind him. They were perfectly recognizable. They belonged to Victor, Belch, and the one and only Henry Bowers. The nightmare was not over yet, it seemed. Ben looked around for a place to go to Earth. 10. He came out of his hiding place about 2 hours later, dirtier than ever, but a little refreshed. Incredible as it seemed to him, he had dozed off. When he had heard the three of them behind him, coming after him still, Ben had come dangerously close to freezing up completely, like an animal caught in the headlamps of an oncoming truck. A paralytic drowsiness began to steal over him. The idea of simply lying down, curling up into a ball like a hedgehog, and letting them do whatever they felt they had to occurred to him. It was a crazy idea, but it also seemed like a strangely good idea. But instead, Ben began to move toward the sound of the running water and those other kids. He tried to untangle their voices and get the sense of what they were saying, anything to shake off that scary paralysis of the spirit. Some project. They were talking about some project. One or two of the voices were even a little familiar. There was a splash, followed by a burst of good-natured laughter. The laughter filled Ben with a kind of stupid longing and made him more aware of his dangerous position than anything else had done. If he was going to be caught, there was no need to let these kids in for a dose of his medicine. Ben turned right again. Like many large people, he was remarkably light-footed. He passed close enough to the boys to see their shadows moving back and forth between him and the bright water, but they neither saw him nor heard him. Gradually, their voices began to fall behind. He came to a narrow path which had been beaten down to the bare earth. Ben considered it for a moment, then shook his head a little. He crossed it and plunged into the undergrowth again. He moved more slowly now, pushing bushes aside rather than stampeding through them. He was still moving roughly parallel to the stream the other kids had been playing beside. Even through the intervening bushes and trees, he could see it was much wider than the one into which he and Henry had fallen. Here was another of those concrete cylinders, barely visible amid a snarl of blackberry creepers, humming quietly to itself. Beyond, an embankment dropped off to the stream, and here an old, gnarled elm tree leaned crookedly out over the water. Its roots, half exposed by bank erosion, looked like a snarl of dirty hair. Hoping there wouldn't be bugs or snakes, but too tired and numbly frightened to really care, Ben had worked his way between the roots and into a shallow cave beneath. He leaned back. A root jabbed him like an angry finger. He shifted his position a little, and it supported him quite nicely. Here came Henry, Belch, and Victor. He had thought they might be fooled into following the path, but no such luck. They stood close by him for a moment. Any closer, and he could have reached out of his hiding place and touched them. "Bet them little snot holes back there saw him," Belch said. "Well, let's go find out," Henry replied, and they headed back the way they had come. A few moments later, Ben heard him roar, "What the fuck you kids doing here?" There was some sort of reply, but Ben couldn't tell what it was. The kids were too far away, and this close, the river, it was the Kanduskeag, of course, was too loud. But he thought the kid sounded scared. Ben could sympathize. Then Victor Chris bellowed something Ben hadn't understood at all.
"What a fucking baby dam."
Baby dam? Baby dam? Or maybe Victor had said, "What a damn bunch of babies," and Ben had misheard him.
"Let's break it," Belch proposed.
There were yells of protest followed by a scream of pain. Someone began to cry. Yes, Ben could sympathize. They hadn't been able to catch him, or at least not yet. But here was another bunch of little kids for them to take out their mad on.
"Sure, break it," Henry said.
Splashes, yells, big moronic gusts of laughter from Belch and Victor. An agonized, infuriated cry from one of the little kids.
"Don't give me any of your shit, you stuttering little freak," Henry Bowers said. "I ain't taking no more shit from nobody today."
There was a splintering crack. The sound of running water downstream grew louder and roared briefly before quieting to its former placid chuckle. Ben suddenly understood. Baby Dam, yes, that was what Victor had said. The kids, two or three of them it had sounded like when he passed by, had been building a dam. Henry and his friends had just kicked it apart. Ben even thought he knew who one of the kids was. The only stuttering little freak he knew from Derry School was Bill Denbro, who was in the other fifth grade classroom. "You didn't have to do that," a thin and fearful voice cried out, and Ben recognized that voice as well, although he could not immediately put a face with it. "Why did you do that?"
"Because I felt like it, fucknuts," Henry roared back. There was a meaty thud. It was followed by a scream of pain. The scream was followed by weeping. "Shut up," Victor said. "Shut up that crying kid, or I'll pull your ears down and tie them under your chin."
The crying became a series of choked snuffles.
"We're going," Henry said, "but before we do, I want to know one thing. You seen a fat kid in the last 10 minutes or so? Big fat kid all bloody and cut up?"
There was a reply too brief to be anything but no.
"You sure?" Belch asked. "You better be mushmouth."
I'm sure, Bill Denbro replied.
"Let's go," Henry said. "He probably waded across back that way."
"Ta-ta, boys," Victor Chris called. "It was a real baby dam, believe me. You're better off without it."
Splashing sounds. Belch's voice came again, but further away now. Ben couldn't make out the words. In fact, he didn't want to make out the words. Closer by, the boy who had been crying now resumed. There were comforting noises from the other boy. Ben had decided there was just the two of them, Stuttering Bill and the Weeper. He half sat, half lay where he was, listening to the two boys by the river and the fading sounds of Henry and his dinosaur friends crashing toward the far side of the barrens. Sunlight flicked at his eyes and made little coins of light on the tangled roots above and around him. It was dirty in here, but it was also cozy, safe. The sound of running water was soothing. Even the sound of the crying kid was sort of soothing. His aches and pains had faded to a dull throb, and the sound of the dinosaurs had faded out completely. He would wait a while, just to be sure they weren't coming back, and then he would make tracks. Ben could hear the throb of the drainage machinery coming through the earth, could even feel it. A low, steady vibration that went from the ground to the root he was leaning against and then into his back. He thought of the Morlocks again, of their naked flesh. He imagined it would smell like the dank and shitty air that had come up through the vent holes of that iron cap. He thought of their wells driven deep into the earth, wells with rusty ladders bolted to their sides. He dozed, and at some point his thoughts became a dream. 11. It wasn't Morlocks he dreamed of. He dreamed of the thing which had happened to him in January, the thing which he hadn't quite been able to tell his mother. It had been the first day of school after the long Christmas break. Mrs. Douglas had asked for a volunteer to stay after and help her count the books that had been turned in just before the vacation. Ben had raised his hand.
"Thank you, Ben," Mrs. Douglas had said, favoring him with a smile of such brilliance that it warmed him down to his toes.
"Suck ass," Henry Bowers remarked under his breath.
It had been the sort of Maine winter day that is both the best and the worst. Cloudless, eye-wateringly bright, but so cold it was a little frightening. To make the 10-degree temperature worse, there was a strong wind to give the cold a bitter cutting edge. Ben counted books and called out numbers. Mrs. Douglas wrote them down, not bothering to double-check his work even on a random basis, he was proud to note. And then they both carried the books down to the storage room through the halls where radiators clanked dreamily. At first the school had been full of sounds, slamming locker doors, the clackety-clack of Mrs. Thomas's typewriter in the office, the slightly off-key choral renditions of the glee club upstairs, the nervous thud, thud, thud of basketballs from the gym, and the scrooch and thud of sneakers as players drove toward the baskets or cut turns on the polished wood floor. Little by little these sounds ceased, until, as the last set of books was totted up, one short, but it hardly mattered, Mrs. Douglas sighed, they were all holding together on a wing and a prayer. The only sounds were the radiators, the faint whish, whish of Mr. Fazio's broom
as he pushed colored sawdust up the hall floor and the howl of the wind outside. Ben looked toward the book room's one narrow window and saw that the light was fading rapidly from the sky. It was 4 o'clock and dusk was at hand. Membranes of dry snow blew around the icy jungle gym and skirled between the teeter-totters, which were frozen solidly into the ground. Only the thaws of April would break those bitter winter welds. He saw no one at all on Jackson Street. He looked a moment longer, expecting a car to roll through the Jackson-Wycham intersection, but none did. Everyone in Derry save himself and Mrs. Douglas might be dead or fled, at least from what he could see from here. He looked toward her and saw, with a touch of real fright, that she was feeling almost exactly the same things he was feeling himself. He could tell by the look in her eyes. They were deep and thoughtful and far off. Not the eyes of a schoolteacher in her 40s, but those of a child. Her hands were folded just below her breasts, as if in prayer. "I'm scared," Ben thought, "and she's scared too. But what are we really scared of?" He didn't know. Then she looked at him and uttered a short, almost embarrassed laugh. "I've kept you too late," she said. "I'm sorry, Ben." "That's okay." He looked down at his shoes. He loved her a little, not with the frank, unquestioning love he had lavished on Mrs. Thibodeau, his first grade teacher, but he did love her. "If I drove, I'd give you a ride," she said, "but I don't. My husband's going to pick me up around 5:15. If you'd care to wait, we could..." "No, thanks," Ben said. "I ought to get home before then." This was not really the truth, but he felt a queer aversion to the idea of meeting Mrs. Douglas's husband. "Maybe your mother could." "She doesn't drive either," Ben said. "I'll be all right. It's only a mile home." "A mile's not far when it's nice, but it can be a very long way in this weather. You'll go in somewhere if it gets too cold, won't you, Ben?" "Oh, sure. I'll go into Costello's Market and stand by the stove a little while, or something. Mr. Gaudreau doesn't mind. And I got my snow pants, my new Christmas scarf, too." Mrs. Douglas looked a little reassured, and then she glanced toward the window again. "It just looks so cold out there," she said. So inimical." He didn't know the word, but he knew exactly what she meant. Something just happened. What? He had seen her, he realized suddenly, as a person instead of just a teacher. That was what had happened. Suddenly he had seen her face in an entirely different way, and because he did, it became a new face. The face of a tired poet. He could see her going home with her husband, sitting beside him in the car with her hands folded as the heater hissed and he talked about his day. He could see her making them dinner. An odd thought crossed his mind, and a cocktail party question rose to his lips. "Do you have children, Mrs. Douglas?" "I often think at this time of the year that people really weren't meant to live this far north of the equator," she said. "At least not in this latitude." Then she smiled, and some of the strangeness either went out of her face or his eye. He was able to see her, at least partially, as he always had. "But you'll never see her that way again, not completely," he thought, dismayed.